Good morning, everybody. This is Robin Ayoub again, and I'm recording our second episode today. Recorded one at 10 o'clock, and now we're recording one at 12 o'clock with my good friend, Wynn Schwartau. He was joining me again for the second time, back by popular demand on the channel. We've had an interesting conversation with Wynn, I want to say about 3 to 4 months ago now.
I don't know. That implies I have some concept of time. No.
I don't have, you know, I go by, you know, my, they call that the cognitive memory, which, you know, this is episode 250 we're recording, Wynn. So I have a little bit of less of that. Like, I don't remember every one of them by date, but I do remember the last 20, for instance. And
wow.
You were before that.
Okay.
So I record, you know, close to 5-6 of them per week now. Some weeks are doing like 10 episodes per week. But I love the conversation that you and I had. I was just reading the transcript of our last conversation. It sounded like so off the cuff, just two guys having a conversation. And that's why people loved it, by the way. It was so authentic.
You know, the only note I have on my paper is the local Jets pizza menu. That's it.
No prep, guys. No prep.
No, I mean, if I don't know what I'm talking about by now, I mean, we're all in serious trouble.
I am 100% with you. For those of you who are joining us the first time, and the first time you hear me and my friend Wynn Schwartau talking, you need to understand who Wynn is. So I'm just going to give you a little bit of a background on him, just to pretext this conversation into the right concept of where we're going to go with this dialogue. Wynn has been living on the edge of what most people haven't thought about since 1983. He's the man who coined electronic Pearl Harbor, authored the seminal book Information Warfare, and is now directing a formidable mind toward cognitive security. The idea that our brain needs the same kind of hardened defenses architecture we've been building for our networks, that's his thesis, that's his book. His new book is The Art and Science of Metaware, examines how AI-driven reality distortion, disinformation, and algorithmic addiction are reshaping who we are and what we mean and how we behave in the future. And this is going to be a very honest conversation, extension of what we talked about, Wynn. And the reason I wanted to have you back is to A, see where we are right now, and B, hopefully the art and science of Metaware is out now and you can talk a little bit about it. And also to update the audience, the threat environment that we live in, I'm talking about the security, cybersecurity threat environment that we live in right now. Obviously, from what I'm hearing, from the signals that I'm hearing, from the people that I've interviewed and the comments that I've seen after our conversation last, it seems to be increasing. And I wanted to get a pulse from you.
You know, sometimes, and I've heard this a lot. Yeah. Oh, it's more and more and more. I'm not saying it is. I'm not saying it's not. I will say awareness is certainly a lot higher. It is, more people are talking about it. So does that mean it's worse? Or does it just mean we're talking about it more and it seems to be worse? I don't know that answer. I really don't. And I'm just glad that people are actually talking about it, because metawar involves fundamentally three separate disciplines. If we look at it from a cybersecurity standpoint for a moment, we always talk about the ISO layers, you know, layers 1 through 7. Layer 1 is physical. That's the kinetic. That's bombs and bullets and all the stuff, the physical stuff. Layers 2 through 7 is all the cybers that a lot of your audience and I've lived in for many, many years. Cognitive warfare is layers 8, 9, and 10. And that is working at the mind, trying to change minds, whether it's at the individual level, the enterprise level, or the societal level. When you do layers 1 through 10 and look at it as a single entity, that is metawar. You're combining them all.
And you know, for the audience, Wynn Schwartau is a very recognizable name when it comes to security. If you guys are involved in a cybersecurity space, you probably heard him speak read his books, etc. But when you didn't come to this by, you know, by accident, you've decided you were a recording engineer before. And you know, you've told this story before, but for the audience who's listening to you the first time, I hate to ask you to repeat this. But when did you first realize the brain worked differently from other security systems in people? You were asking back then very uncomfortable questions, as I recall from the last conversation, that nobody else was asking.
When I was very, very fortunate to have sold my last company, and that was in 2016, early 2017. And part of the deal that I had with the company that bought me, bought our company, was that I could run around the world and research and think. Wow, that was great. Thank you. Right. And so I started getting very interested in how to make, at that point, security awareness more effective. How do you make the brain more receptive to ideas? Is it traditional security awareness training? Is it a bigger hammer on the head? Is it forget it, we've lost? What techniques are there? And so I was running around going to neuroscience conferences, trying to learn their language. And it's a completely different language and get up. So I spent a couple of years doing that. And in the process, discovered that there is this whole field of influence that had been existing for many, many years. And it goes back to World War II and even before. You could look at Machiavelli. You could look at early Russian propaganda in the Tsarist days. You could look at all of these things. So it's nothing new. But combining cybersecurity with cognitive security, and how, at that point, how do I make security awareness, how do I change people's behavior, was what got me into it. And then as I got deeper and deeper into it, I realized, holy shit, this is worse than I, and it, well, you see, I've spent 5 years reading and studying and looking at what had been done and researched at universities and the military, and realized that we were going to be facing a new kind of war. Now, something interesting happened, because back when I did information warfare in 92, whatever year it was, and I was talking about electronic Pearl Harbors, everybody's freaking out. Where'd you get all this information? Where'd you learn all this? And it's all classified. And I said, it can't be classified, because I thought of it. Well, there's no way you thought of it. A similar thing is happening now. I'm hearing from people that, you know, you're really not supposed to know that and be talking too much about that. And that is coming largely filtering down from the military global security organizations who have been treating aspects of cognitive security very, very seriously for the last, I'll say, 15 years, arguably. And so it's like kind of going down the same path again, but just expanding it from cyber war exclusively, cyber conflict, whatever term you're comfortable with, into cognitive conflict.
So electronic Pearl Harbor in 1991, you coined that. And what does it feel like right now to, you know, to be proven you were right? You were right.
Sad.
Back then.
I mean, it's sad. Throughout all of those years, it was, and I don't want this to come across egotistical at all, but it was every now and then something, and I'd get, when you predicted that. Didn't you say that was going to happen? And that happened a lot. And in one way, that's supposed to make the ego feel good. But in a more profound way, it was very upsetting that the communities at large, the leadership around the world at all levels, were not taking the threats, the issues very seriously at all. I mean, these were the days when companies were actually asking, should we connect to the internet? And at that point, I guess I was already 20 years ahead saying, well, yeah, you're gonna, you have to, but you need to do it with good thinking, with good planning.
Or do we have to run them through the telex story?
My wife and I, God, now that goes way back into my prior career. There was a telex machine, and she had to walk down the hill to the Western Union office in order to be able to communicate with our partners over in England. It was a very different world. So over the years, it's the more of the predictions that I had that came true is disheartening.
It's hard
because there's really not any. We as a collective society, cybersecurity people, everybody involved, big tech, ad tech, and leadership, should have done one hell of a better job than we have. And that's one of the reasons we're in the sad state we are.
And
what you hear about, all right, now there's a whole new ransomware this. There's a whole new attack vector here. That's disheartening.
Disheartening, absolutely. I was listening to the news, something close to home here not too long ago. Last week or the week before, an old lady in Barrie, Ontario, receives an email pretending to be the Prime Minister of Canada, offering some sort of a pension investment, and she loses her entire pension fund.
Unfortunately, there is only more and more of that because of the bot farms, because of AI, and targeting senior citizens, of which I am one.
By the way, tomorrow I'll be classified as senior citizen. Tomorrow is my birthday. And I crossed that bridge, that chasm, to 60 years old, I guess.
Jeez, you're a youngster. Come on, that's young. If I were 60, I'd still have all the energy that I had back then. And I got to temper it down these days. But congratulations and stay healthy.
I appreciate it. Now, you look at the arc, when you look at the arc of information warfare from the 90s mm-hmm. to meta war today, what is the single biggest thing that you changed in your opinion, like technology, adversaries, the adversaries, probably they're changing their tactics.
Mm-hmm.
And the adversaries not necessarily be in a country, could be an individual, a mobster somewhere, I don't know. Could be somebody mm-hmm. who means ill to people, or the human vulnerability. I feel like with the amount of access that we have right now, with the amount of devices that we have right now, the amount of ways we can access information, that increases vulnerability like through the roof.
Back then, you preface that with, you know, kind of looking back again, we should have listened to the Russians. And I'm sure that is not a popular thing to say, but we should have listened to the Russians. In the very early days of information warfare, my take on it and a lot of my colleagues' takes on it were very technical. We're looking at how do you break in, where's the networks, how do you eavesdrop, and all of that, which is all legitimate, it was all fair. The Russians, I had at that point some really good contacts through some of the three letters here, and we had a conference called InfoWarCon that lasted 10 or 12 years before I sold it. And the Russians concept of information warfare, they go, oh, you Americans, you only look at the bits and the bytes, you forget it about this. And they were looking at how to manipulate the mind, and they felt that the psychological and the neuroscientific approach, even those terms didn't really exist that well back in the early 90s, but that was fundamentally it. How do you mess with people's minds? And when you look at a book, and I really recommend it, I may have mentioned it before, a KGB propaganda specialist and deception specialist defected to Canada in 1984. Oh, no, he wrote the book. I forget what year he defected, in the 70s sometime. He wrote a book, and it's called Love Letter to America. The gentleman's name is Yuri Bezmenov, and Love Letter to America, you can get the free PDFs online. It's 80 pages long and the scariest book you're ever going to read, because he outlines how to take over the mind of the American citizenry.
Now, you know, the art of science of meta war,
mm-hmm.
Some of the core thesis around that is you say the humans need a cognitive immune system. I love the cognitive immune system statement. What does that actually mean in practical terms, Wynn?
Well, the first thing I'm going to say is not all neuroscientists agree with the term. Because I'm not a PhD and an academic, so I use the term, but they know what we're talking about. Cognitive immune system is a defensive system against information. And there are so many ways of looking at it. In fact, I have a new book I'm working on, which goes through perhaps a new approach on how to defend against it. But the cognitive immune system should mirror what we have in cyber and mirror what we have biologically. And we have biologically the majority of our body is covered with some level of mucus-like substance to get rid of the first level of pathogens that are circulating around. In the cyber world, the first level of pathogens are hopefully gotten rid of up at the tier one providers. And there's a lot of crap going on up there that we hopefully will never see. Then you have the tier two, tier three, and there's various levels of filtering that go on. For a mental immune system, it is really about filtering. It's what makes sense, what is real. And I hate to, I don't want to go down the argument of what's real right now, because that's a separate discussion. But what is real to you? What is a fact? What is evidence? What can be proven? What is non-negotiable information, data, things? Science is really what it is. And when people don't have the ability to do what the popular term is, a critical thinking, they can fall down the mental rabbit hole of conspiracies, false beliefs, misinformation, disinformation, fake news, on and on and on very, very quickly. Humans, we were built as a biological species to be able to survive. So we don't drink the dirty water because we can smell it. Don't eat the poisonous plants because that whole clan died. Don't eat it. Okay, and we're learning very slowly over tens of thousands of years. Humans were never, we were not designed to defend against information. We barely had language at that point. So today with the, what is it, 10 to the 33rd bytes of information are created every year, that's information overload.
Yeah.
That is too much information, absolutely. And that creates mental DDoS, whether it's you and me individually, all the way up to the organizations and society. Too much information, and we don't have a native filtering system.
But is this the point that you're making earlier, the parallel systems, the silicon and the carbon systems? Is that what you meant? Okay. Yeah. So meaning that our brains are our networks, right? Is that what it means?
The brain is a network. We are networks. Our body is a network. Our body connects to our brain in network ways. The sensory systems are definitely networks. Everything is a network. When you look at nature, it's a network. It's a cycle. Absolutely. It's a loop.
Connected, right?
Everything is connected. Absolutely.
In your opinion, sorry, like if you can add to that, is what does cybersecurity existing defense framework right now gives us that perhaps some cognitive security researchers out there can actually steal and apply right now?
A filtering system. And when
is that easier said than done, though, Wynn?
I'm sorry?
Isn't that easier said than done, the filtering
system? Yes, much easier said than done. And that is, I'm very fortunate to be part of the Cognitive Security Institute. And I think there's 2,000 members now. And when I've got questions, I go to them. And when I say something that's full of shit, they get on my case, correct me. We work together. And that's what the collaboration is. It is much easier said than done. There has been some research over the last 15 years that is pretty good. But yes, we do not know exactly how to build, strengthen the cognitive immune system. We know how to beat it down pretty well. We've been doing that for a long time. That's what Machiavellianism is. That's what authoritarianism is. We know how to beat people into submission. What we need to do is learn how to build those defenses so people see those attacks on their identity, on their mental acuity, and how to be able to differentiate the amount of information that they are even capable of absorbing, because we have limits. We have absolute mathematically defined limits as to how much information we are capable of absorbing. Now, it's going to be a little different for everybody, obviously, but the fundamental numbers, we know what they are.
It's not the weakness. That's the weakness, I'm assuming. And here's my thesis on this one. Here's my illustration on it. It's because when the enemy knows how much you can absorb, then the flood of the information coming at you, you don't dig deeper into the details to understand so you can filter. So what you do, you end up skimming the top of it. Hence, the cognitive mind start building patterns that they're not real.
They the attackers know a lot more than the defenders, and this is exactly what we've been through in cybersecurity.
Of course they do.
Forever. The attackers know how to bully our mind. They know how to addict it. The ad tech, big ads, they know how to make the dopamine and the chemical feel goods into your brain when you click a button and you get a like. The like button is an addictive technology. And I think I just saw yesterday that Meta could be on the hook potentially for $1.4 trillion because a recent court case just came through that, yes, they have proven in certain cases that they knowingly have been building addictive technology. In that case, it is the algorithm, defining the algorithm to make you happy. So if you have an environment, an information environment, and you do certain things that feel good, the tendency is you're going to do more of that. We as humans don't want to do things that make us feel bad. And that is an incredibly powerful attack vector.
You also patented the time-based security, meaning the idea that the security is a function of time, not just technology.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can you explain that a little bit, if you don't mind, Wynn?
Time-based security, boy, that's something I'm very proud of because it has been used and finally absorbed into so many different areas. And I don't have a patent on it or anything. It's all open source. It doesn't matter. Time-based security basically says, in order to be able to defend, and I'm just saying a system, and we'll go with technical systems, I need to know how fast the attackers are working. So I got to think like the bad guy. So the example I often use is the bad guys are going to rob a jewelry store. There's a jewelry store down on Main Street. And at night, they got a few trinkets in the windows and all that. So they got the tape around the window for the security system. Now, I'm the bad guy. I want to rob that store. What information do I need to know? I need three pieces of information only. One, how long is it going to take me to break in to that jewelry store? The answer is a rock. So however long a rock takes to go through. Number two, part of that should be the detection. Is that rock detected by noise, vibration, whatever alarm system you've got built in? How fast should that react? If I'm thinking like the bad guy and I want to be safe, that should happen very, very quickly, very quickly. Second piece of information I need to know is the reaction. How long does it take that system, that protective system in the jewelry store, to get in touch with the response unit? Call the cops, call the rent-a-cops, whatever it is. Set up an alarm, whatever the defensive mechanism. How long does that take? All right, in today's world, it should be under a second or two, really, to be able to get if you've designed a system very well. The third part is the one that ends up being so important, and the bad guys, we see it in every movie. How long does it take the cops to show up?
I see.
And that is not going to be 10 seconds, 5 seconds. That's going to be, and I'm making this up, 90 seconds, 3 minutes. Depends upon so many things. And that's why we see in movies, there's always one guy saying, all right, that's a minute. That's a minute 10, minute 30. We got to be out of here at 2:30 because they have researched what the reaction is. So time-based security says, if I know my detection time and I know my reaction time, the only way that I can call myself secure is if I am able to measure the amount of defensive time my defensive systems provide. And it's that simple. And if you don't meet that formula, you're not going to have a state of security. Period. End of story.
You know, you bring a very valid point because I've seen many times people complaining about the slow response of security teams in certain cases where there's a robbery happening in a lot of cities around North America and Europe. They're letting the robbery happen because they let the insurance companies deal with it. I don't want to get into that whole cycle of, letting these things happen. But there is a documented cases where the police didn't even show up in some cases. Just let somebody else deal with it and then come back and report it.
That is the economic, I don't, I'm a geek. I'm not an economist. I know that the time-based security formula works. Now, one of the things that can be applied to actuarials or insurance companies, and
But the time that I was referring to in my answer is that the bad guys knows that in some cases the police is not showing up.
They don't even care.
They're taking their time.
If the bad guys have done their research and they know that they're doing it in a bad neighborhood that the cops don't want to go to, or that it's up at the top of the hill behind the fences and they have no way... Yes, there are exceptions to everything.
Correct.
Time-based security is a generalized formula that can be applied with all of those exceptions. You just have to expand the formulas, and you can go many, many layers deep in time-based security. There is no limit as to the amount of granularity that you can apply. So if you want to add the economic layer, go for it. I'll show you how to do it, but I'm not an economist. I'll show you where it goes in the formula.
It all it also add to our cost as a society. That's what I was going with.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If things that we ignore, that's what part of, and I'm going to use the word, that's part of what cognitive surrender is, is giving up your autonomy because it's easier.
So of course. Now, here's the fun part. Our common friend, Len No, who was on the localization fireside chat, as you were, mm-hmm. and we actually participated in a panel all together, asked me to ask you this one directly. And for the audience, close your ears if you don't want to hear it. When are the BS meters are going to be available for purchase? But he's seriously asking a practical cognitive defense tool actually look like in the regular for the regular person. In 2026. Let's get the first answer first for Lynn.
All right. BS meters. Some of us have really good BS detection. Some of us don't. Some of us have it in some areas, not so much in other areas. I can make Len a BS detector right now. It won't work, but it'll look like one. But the more experiences that you have growing up from the ages of zero and in those environments where you're exposed to BS, and I grew up in New York, so boy, that was full of BS, was through my parents and street smarts, learning what's BS and not BS. I remember Three Card Monty when I was 15.
Yeah. The first one, probably don't take candy from a stranger, right?
Played it once and that was it. Back in those days, the cop on the local beat was your friend. I mean, it was a whole different world. But my BS meter was tuned very, very high. And it's when everybody has it to a certain extent. And that's part of what the enhancing the cognitive immune system is about. You tell me something and I go, wait a minute. That doesn't quite make sense. Now, I may not be able to argue with you exactly on a particular point, but I go,
Doesn't sound right.
Doesn't sound right. That is one kind of BS detection. When we're looking at news, is your BS detector tuned to the information, or is it also tuned to the information source? How much trust do you have? And BS detection, Mr. Len, no, my dear friend, trust. And you know, I go on and on about trust, that if Len tells me something, I'm going to assume, number one, there's a possibility he's trolling me. And I got to go through real quick. Okay, is this bullshit or not? But that's how in our community, we kind of, we train each other. We keep our skills up that way. But when somebody random says something that whether it's at a bar, on an airplane, wherever, and I'm going, no, wait a minute, no, I read a book, and I'm not swearing by that book, but that's different than what I've heard. So it's not accepting everything, not trusting everything at face value, because the number of bad actors out there today, multiplied by bots and AI. My new mantra, and the one we use at the Cognitive Security Institute, trust nothing, verify everything at least twice.
Yeah, twice.
Because verifying once could be another bad source.
I know.
Another bad. And even if a lot of people say, oh, well, we go to the academic sources. Academia is having its own issue with pay to publish.
Yeah.
And so you, let's say you're a researcher and you've done this great cognitive paper. You got this cognitive paper. And one of the big academic publishers will say, we'll publish that for you and it'll run you $10,000. So now it is legitimately published in a legitimate journal of some level of efficacy. And now it becomes a primary source. How do we know in the academic world, the accuracy, bullshit factor, and trust value that I should have? So that's even making it harder these days. So verify at least twice. The amount of time I spend verifying stuff well exceeds the amount of time I spend just reading.
So when it sounds like you're educating the public by telling them you have to verify things, it sounds like it's a more of a human manual process versus a system.
Well, no, it can be system because a bullshit meter. All right. Let's go to Daniel Kahneman, one of the greatest philosophers who applied great thinking to neuroscience. Roughly, and I know all the neuroscientists out there are going to object to some of this, but roughly, we have two systems in our brain. One is system one, which is our high-speed reaction system. You're walking down the street and you hear a gunshot. Well, it got your attention, and you're either going to run, probably the wrong answer, or you're going to hit the deck, which is a smarter answer in most cases. You hear a car horn in the city. What are you? You're reacting, and that is system one reaction. Somebody hits you. Somebody does these something to you that gets your attention, and this is all about attention. That's what fake news, bad news, bullshit, that's what it's all about, is about attention and the feel-good chemicals. So now the same thing we have in our brain. What is it that will automatically make me call BS? And that is where developing and strengthening the mental immune system comes along. And there's a group of people out of Cambridge University from their psychology department and led by Professor Sandra Van Linden. And they created a mechanism called pre-bunking. So you tell me a fact, and I say, you're wrong. Well, then you go, I'm right. And we're at loggerheads. No amount of facts will change your mind. You are in a complete locked-in belief state. However, if I or you are subjected to, prior to us having that conversation, that what you tend to believe might be BS, then when we have a conversation, there's at least a crack in the door that we can have a conversation. And that's what pre-bunking is. And pre-bunking has been proven to be very, very effective. It was originally done, and the research done against disinformation and misinformation in the late teens of 2017, 18, 19. And so when it comes to strengthening the mental immune system and BS detection, Len, and what have you, I'm working on a model now that helps us get from too much information, all that massive amounts of stuff that there's no way I can possibly, down to a manageable level. How do we do that? And that what we're looking at is similar techniques to pre-bunking to apply to critical ignoring, because you have to critically ignore the majority of the crap out there before you can pay attention and do critical thinking. Everybody's saying critical thinking, and I don't disagree with them, but the vast majority of people are not offering up. You have to start with filtering. You have to start with critical ignoring in order to make it manageable, just like we do in cybers, just like the body does. It's no different. It's a system.
So we continue the conversation. I again apologize for, I got somebody at the door and I had to take care of it.
No worries.
But, we'll do the edit. So you also, you've been at DEF CON for 30 years and that's...
This will be my 33rd. Yeah.
So you've seen the hacker community go from misunderstood fringe to a recognized national security asset. That's quite the transformation, to be honest with you. I never thought this would happen, to be honest with you. I thought this is going to be always be on the dark side, but they seem to be moving in as a national security asset. People are making use of those individuals. Do you think the cognitive security community is on the same trajectory or this is what needs to happen to accelerate?
Boy, that's a question that takes hours. The way back when I got in trouble, and this is the early 90s, when I was suggesting to the, such as the cybersecurity community was back then, it really wasn't much, is that, wait a minute, these guys, we need these guys. We, in order to be able to defend, you have to know how to attack. And these guys are going into the systems and they're having fun. But by and large, it was games and what have you. They were just having some fun, nothing really mean. But we can learn from them. Why don't we bring them into our system? Wow, they're criminals. And there was this huge system one knee-jerk reaction that said, no, we're smart enough. We can do it without them. Well, that ended up being wrong, of course. And now, if that's why there's penetration testing, that's why there's red team, blue teams, that's why there's purple teams, is if you can't know how to attack, how can you possibly know how to defend? Now, to move this over to the psych world, social engineering has always been one of the greatest attack vectors around. The work of Kevin Mitnick over the years, social engineering villages, it has been explored and talked about in depth for 20 years. Social engineering is an early form of cognitive warfare. It is a piece of it. We can learn a lot of what cognitive attacks look like and how to take advantage and essentially attack the mind of people who are supposed to be protecting the secrets in the social engineering terms. So, and here I'm going to give a crash commercial plug. DEF CON is coming up, obviously, and that's a hacker summer camp. So there's Black Hat, B-Sides, DEF CON, and we are holding the world's first cognitive security conference, and it's in Vegas at the Tuscany Hotel on August 6th and 7th. And we are bringing together people from all over the world to talk about cognitive security, cognitive warfare, defensive techniques, bringing interdisciplinary experts together from psychology, from the military, from academia, and people like me who have very little formal training in any of this, who are just thinking wild thoughts. So if this is something that your audience is interested in, the merger of what is happening between cyber and cognitive warfare and the overall overarching meta war, cognitivesecurityinstitute.org, take a look, and I think you will have your mind blown.
You know, and it's...
End of pitch.
No, but that's very fundamental, like, to see us thinking along the lines of bringing people together to talk about it, such an important topic. That people's been trying to solve it, and you know what? You mentioned, oh, you're not an academia in it. You're not, you know, you're just. But most people are not thinking about it. I mean, I don't know of anybody out there that there is a PhD in cognitive cybersecurity. Is there? I don't know if there's a program for that.
I know a lot of the academics who are really well versed in this subject. I don't know though if there is specifically a course. Or a pathway academically to do it. But I do know that some of the PhD papers that have been worked on and are being worked on do that merger, and they are really seriously looking at it. So there's some really brilliant people that are going to be out at this event. So if you're out there for Black Hat or DEF CON or B-Sides, come on down. And
So from a research perspective, would you be concerned when that, you know, if this goes into, let's sort of some sort of an academic program, be it whatever, BA, PhD, master, whatever the levels they're going to do, postdoctoral or whatever it is, would you be concerned if this leans to the left or to the right? Wouldn't you want to keep it neutral?
Well, that's one of the things that we have been exceedingly careful at the Cognitive Security Institute, and I've been exceedingly careful at since I got involved in this, is the entire issue of developing and strengthening your mental immune system is not left, is not right, is not Christian, is not Hindu. It is none of these things. That is the content. It is about the process that you as an individual learn to go through. It has nothing to do with politics at all. We don't talk politics. We don't talk contentious issues at all, because the process is the same. You're telling me something. I'm calling bullshit on you. whether it's a left or a right or a God or an atheist, doesn't matter. It's how do you have a cogent conversation? How do you get people to be able to talk to each other and keep system one gut reactions out of those equations? Because that by that point, you should be into system two, critical thinking, slow, methodical, working it out. System one should get rid of the bullshit automatically. And that these are not well-defined. These are not binary conditions that you're going to go bullshit, not bullshit universally. It's like every individual. We all have our own bullshit meters, Len. Len, you hear me? Len, yeah. You there?
Knock, knock. Is Len there? I just want to make sure that the audience understand that. So, you know, I always hear some wacky story coming to me from somebody. And as soon as I quiz it a little bit, say, where did you get that? Where did you hear that? Well, it was on TikTok. If I hear that one more time, I'm just going to tell you one thing. You guys are crazy.
All right. I use a series of things in a lot of my work called pithograms, and it's coming out in my new book. I think there's some in Meta War. And one of the things that you hear from people that have belief systems, again, regardless of where they are on any spectrum, and they will say something. And you just said, where'd you get that? What? And they say something to the equivalent of, it's on the internet, do your own research. What that literally means is there is no evidence and I have no fucking idea what I'm talking about.
That's right. And they blame it. It's on the internet, basically.
Yeah. Do your own research is an absolutely insane answer when you're attempting to have a cogent conversation based upon evidence, fact, and the scientific method.
Now, let's talk a little bit about policy, because last time I spoke to you about policy, did anything change there? And what do you think should happen at a policy level? Like, imagine yourself 20 minute with policymaker in government. What would you tell them? By the way, how is your relationship with the policymakers?
I did a fair amount with the Biden administration. I really try to stay out of policy because I hate it. Because that's a formalization process. And the work that I do is really so much more abstract and theoretical. I'm not trying to provide hardcore answers and put anything in stone. The policymakers should take all of our discussions. And now I'm not saying just me, but, you know, I mean, everybody from the Cognitive Security Institute and places like that, and take to heart how we actually as human beings function, what we really are. We are not binary creatures. We are all on a spectrum. And we're having a hard enough time accepting that with whether it's the autism spectrum, Asperger's spectrum, whatever term you want to use for that. It's not, he has autism. No, that answer doesn't work. We all have it to some extent, and some feature manifests itself. So policy, no. I got a lot of policy friends. We talk. I stay the hell out of it. I would never want to write a policy at all.
But do you think, though, there should be policy involvement? Not by you, but do you think there should be some sort of a policy in place?
The only place I see this happening right now is in Europe.
Yeah, I see that in the UK, which people are not happy about, but I think from what I'm seeing, I don't know if they are or not. I have no idea.
NATO is very involved from a policy standpoint. The EU has committed roughly 100 billion euros over 10 to 12 years to work on cognitive resilience from a societal level. Most of the research that had been going on here in the United States was torn apart starting in early 2022 by certain political factions, and the ability to do unbiased, academically free research has been fundamentally destroyed and defunded by certain policymakers. So I'm really excited to be able to, I haven't met a lot of these people. I've met some of them, but in Vegas, we're all going to be in one room together. And I am just so excited about that, so that we can learn what is going on in Europe and what can we do, how can we help, and what are the lessons learned. because they're way ahead of us in the thinking of it, the funding of it, and the acceptance of it.
No, that's the August 6th you're talking about, right?
So yes,
that's
the
August 6th.
Cognitive Security Conference. Yes.
Yeah. And I don't know if you can get your assistant to send me some information on this one. I'll include it in my post-editing publishing of the event that we're doing today. So I'll include that. Now, you know, to be honest with you, like I spent like most of me, you've heard about my career. So I've spent most of my life helping people, you know, make language travel across cultural borders. You know, I work in the language industry. And lately I keep asking myself, what's the difference between culturally adapted persuasion and cognitive manipulation? Where's the line? Is there a line?
Well, as soon as you use the word line, you have turned me off. Because that implies binaryism.
It's not binaryism. Yeah, I get it.
There is it's a spectrum, but it's not only, cultural persuasion. If I go to Japan and I go to somebody's house.
Okay.
I am culturally expected to remove my shoes before walking in their house. Is that them manipulating me? Is that them cognitively forcing my behavior? Is that me being cognitively aware of cultural differences? Or is it an amalgamation of them all that the social scientists can go figure out? It's somewhere in that mess. When we go to Europe, are we supposed to tip at restaurants? Well, then you get into that whole thing. So those are the cultural differences. When you go to Southeast Asia, you go to some of the countries there, the behavior that is expected of Westerners is vastly different than what will be tolerated by Western Europe and Eastern Europeans, because we're loud and boisterous and all that. And in South and in the Asian countries, it's very different. So is that them manipulating me? Or I'm not qualified. I don't think there's an answer yet. If there is, please, when you do have the social scientist on who knows the answer, let me know.
We're gonna get a couple. Well, I think we had a
so then I can come to it.
Maybe we'll do a panel on this one with a social
scientist. No, I just want to listen to him. I want to learn.
Well, we'll have to facilitate that. I'll make sure I get a social scientist on this one. For the audience, they're thinking, okay, I'm listening to this. I'm interested in finding out more, but I'm interested in trying to find ways to calibrate my own cognitive defense mechanisms while swimming in all these materials that arrives to me on a daily basis. How do you deal with that personally? How do you keep your cognitive defenses calibrated? Maybe somebody can learn from you.
Trust nothing. Assume it's bullshit. Start there. It's easier. You'll fall down less rabbit holes. Is that perfect? No. Is it a pain in the ass? Yes. Over time, it gets easier. You're just kind of noise. All right. And one of the ways that you can see this and people can see it for themselves, when they're on any online activity that has advertising, do you see the ads? If you see the ads, your system one is not automatically ignoring them for you. When you don't see the ads, you've got some system one engagement going on that is removing, it's critically ignoring for you. When you're on a talk and there's a side thing with all of the Twitter feeds or Discord feeds on the side, and somebody says over there, yeah, he's really right. Well, that you just got a shot of dopamine. Of course you feel good. And then you've got, he's really an asshole. And then you go, no, well, and then you, system one tends to want to fight. That's our natural reaction. Unless you are tuned and you have acclimated a little bit, oy vey, I don't care. I am never going to satisfy 100% of the people 100% of the time. So what do? Turn it off. Turning off an awful lot of your information environment is really the first step. Limit it. And one of the things that I have done, and I've encouraged a lot of folks to do, and I'm not saying I'm right. I'm saying this is what I have done. My social media stuff is virtually non-existent. The only one that I use, not so much for social media, but I use LinkedIn because of verification, and I can double check and who's who and all that. and it's much easier than any of the other open channels. On Facebook, I think I may have 100 people that I know personally. That's it. I don't want 10,000 people. So tuning your information environment is really part of it. Another aspect of it is your media and screen exposure. How much screen exposure do you have? And one of the things I'm doing in this new book is showing people how to self-evaluate where they're wasting their time. And okay, you have 30 seconds or you have 3 minutes. You're waiting at the doctor's office and you have 3 minutes. What do people do?
Yep.
They pick this up and I'm just going to offer another one. Why not shut your eyes, which turns off 85% of your sensory input, and just be, just think, just let your brain do nothing for 3 minutes.
You know, you bring a very valid point, because when I go on vacation, I get less screen time. Like I'm out, I'm exploring, I'm seeing, I'm taking photos of things, and I don't really look at any digital material. And I feel like when I come back from vacation rejuvenated, I feel like a brand new person. Because I don't know if it's connected or not. Maybe the vacation, relaxing, et cetera, it's all related. But less screen time, for me, it feels like it allows for me and my brain to work together a little bit better.
My wife gets on my case sometimes, and she's in the other room listening to this. But it's true. In the evenings, I put my phone away. Why? Because I don't care enough. If you really, really, really need me, you know how to reach me. Or you know how to reach my wife. If you don't, then I probably don't care that much about you. I don't know you, and therefore, why should I be bothered? Something else that people do, and again, I'm not trying to be critical here. I'm observing when people subscribe on whether it's Insta, whatever channel they subscribe. Yeah, I want that. 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 And now they've got 500 feeds coming to them. They are DDoSing themselves. Turn off. How many can you actually really handle?
Yeah. You know, our mutual friend, Len, gave me a story when I did the podcast with him about the two granddaughters he had. A granddaughter is screen exposed and the other one not interested in it. And they can see the development difference between the two kids. Quite remarkable, actually.
The child psychologists and the neuroscientists have already absolutely, without question, found the neuronal development differences in the pathways of the brain of kids today and what the digital influence and screen time is doing to them. I'm not qualified to speak on the exact details. I've read some of the studies, and it is remarkable and it is scary because it's different than you and me, the way we grew up. I had a black and white fuzzy TV, and I had to hold on to the antenna to be able to watch Roy Rogers. I know none of you know who Roy Rogers is. That's fine. And today, it's the exact opposite. You have one thing, and I can get 500 feeds. What are the quality of the feeds? I mean, that's the first thing I'm going to ask is trust. What do I subscribe to? Okay, I do MIT Technology Review, New Scientist. I'm a geek, so I pick a few things that I really enjoy, and that's it. That's it. I've got to keep my brain unloaded all the time because it hurt people. One of the opening chapter of my new book is called "What the Hell Is Wrong with Everybody."
I love that chapter.
And it's everybody, and I'm going to say in the States especially, we all know something's really wrong with everybody, and we all know it's been exacerbated for lots of reasons. I'm not going political or any of that. But a huge amount of it, I subscribe to too much of this bullshit.
It is.
And if people would just think for a second, 100% of our sensory input comes from our five external senses and from what is called interoception, our internal senses, which I have a stomach ache. I feel like I have to vomit, whatever. Our body talking to us.
Yeah.
That's 100%. Our optical system represents over 80% of our sensory input. The other four external senses never turn off. They never, ever turn off. They may be sublimated a little bit during sleep, REM, and what have you, but
they're always on.
Off the input. And none of this is new. It's when you had it back in our day with the kids. I remember my mother, count to 10 and relax, chill, calm. I'm not bringing religion into this, but I'm bringing religion into this because Eastern philosophy is about quieting the mind. And our minds, Western minds, are absolutely filthy with noise. So that is the approach that I'm taking. And recommendation is turn off as much of this as you can. And if you're worried about somebody pinging you at 11 o'clock at night,
turn it off.
Just, you've got, that is part of the process of critical ignoring and to being willing to critically ignore, turning FOMO off, the fear of missing out. One of the greatest, and that affects kids more than, not necessarily more than, but it certainly affects kids tremendously because of their development issue. And if you have that fear, how do we turn that off? And these are all similar types of problems that all go back to critical ignoring, too much information, and learning how to tune the mental immune system and build better filters, and don't be afraid to be offline. One of the interesting things, I just as a quickie, when I'm staying offline in technology, interestingly enough, if you are on a Kindle White, it is not considered screen time.
And why is that?
Because you are absorbed into one single environment that you have chosen. No color, no distractions. It's a focus. And we learn better when we're focused. If you have some of the other, if you read Kindle on this device, you've still got potentially the blue light. You've got the mind thinking, oh, I'm on this device still. It correlates with too much information. So my Kindle is and I'm on my Kindle a lot. It does not count as screen time. It is the closest thing to reading a book, analog books.
Yeah, regular paper.
That we have right now. So turn all the crap off as much as you can. Close your eyes. Give yourself some time to think. Trust nothing. Verify twice, and we're working on some methods to really try to get this to work at scale.
No, I appreciate this conversation. Wynn, great to have you back on the channel. What is the best way for people to follow your work and get the new book and stay in touch with your Wynn world, I'm calling it?
Wynn world. Okay. All of my books are on Amazon. Just use my name, Wynn Schwartau. They're all there. Many of them are free. My older books are up there for free. Time-based security, information warfare. There's a whole series. I forget them all. MetaWar is both a Kindle book and a hard copy book. You can go to WynnSchwartau.com, and it's a vanity site, okay? Deal with it. But it's got a lot of my work in it. And then LinkedIn is where I do my big filtering and say, I'll let you in, I won't let you in, because I don't want 20 million followers.
No, you don't want that.
I know. No, I really enjoy
selective few versus too many.
I enjoy this. I enjoy the small get-togethers. I do not want that thing that all these, what are they called? The influencers. Yeah, I want to influence people. Yeah. But I don't want to try to influence 20 million people because, I mean, hell, I have a face for radio. There's other people that will hopefully pick up on a lot of this work and start being able to build it into other disciplines.
Absolutely. I want to thank you so much, Wynn, for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you. I mean, this is round two, and just be very careful of cognitive surrender.
That's right. Cognitive surrender. I'm going to remember this. And the critical... turning off your
critical
devices.
Critical ignoring. Turn the mother off.
And get rid of the noise. Get rid of the noise.
Get rid of the noise. Absolutely. And, you know, to some people, this sounds like that's just Eastern philosophy. Yeah, oddly enough, an awful lot of...
It doesn't matter what we call it. It works.
Yes, it is. There is Eastern philosophy. Is that religion? I don't talk religion. But the process of quieting the mind. Yes, absolutely. And
this one is going in the vault, Wynn.
Is that a good thing or a bad
thing?
That's
a very good thing. It's going in the vault. I really love the conversation with you. I'll always enjoy our conversation together.
Thank you very much. I do as well.
Please consider this channel as yours. Anytime you have an update, please ping me in. I'd love to have you back. It's one of the best conversations I've had this week or the past few months. You bring
one of the best. What about Len?
Len was like 2-3 months ago.
Yeah, but no, Len does great interview.
I love Len's conversation because he brings such a character to the conversation. I never, like, to be honest with you, and I say this with all the love in my heart for Len, he brings such a good character to the conversation. I love what the cat is doing behind you back there.
She's one of my cats.
She's cool, yeah, man.
One of the things I do to stay, I love reading, but reading sometimes activates the brain too much, and so you got to tone it down. So I have found a series of books and a subgenre of books that are on Kindle are cats who talk to humans and solve mysteries.
Wow.
And so it's a paranormal cat experience, and it is so different than everything else, and nice, simple, linear stories. I find them very relaxing. So I do that every night just to finally pass out and have my nose hit my Kindle.
You know, for everybody out there, make sure you find your way to relax, as Wynn was explaining to us, disconnecting, reducing the noise, whatever you want to call it. But too much noise is hard on the brain, hard on the body, hard on all of us around us. So I want to thank you, Wynn, for coming back to the Localization Fireside Chat.
I'm honored. Thank you.
I really appreciate your time. And continuing to ask the question that most people are still afraid to sit with. In today's conversation, I really enjoyed how we conducted the conversation. Very authentic, very unafraid to tackle the big topics. And for everybody else, if you haven't read it yet, I encourage you to keep an eye on it and go out and get it. The Art and Science of Metawar. Make sure you browse through this book and follow in on winschwarta.com. And catch this episode, 250. And if you haven't done so, please go ahead and download the app. Now we've got all of our content on one app. You don't have to look through the noise, as Wynn was saying. You can just get the Localization Fireside Chat on your mobile, and then you can see all the content that I push out there. This is authentic content, no infomercial. We're not selling anything. We're just trying to convey people's opinion and guests' opinion and conversations to you, the audience. So I want to thank you so much for following us on YouTube, on the podcast channel, and also on the blog post where I summarize these conversations. And from me and the audience to Wynn, thank you for being such a great guest. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Until next time, everybody, I'll see you at the next episode.